You know, I think most people would agree that I have had a day of a perfect storm or a perfect convergence or a convergence from hell. I have spent most of the day today teaching and talking about grief and the crisis of death. And if you're listening and saying, oh my gosh, what kind of job does this person have? I teach at Colorado Christian University. I teach two different classes, and they coincidentally ended up having the same topic on the same day. I talked about the crisis of death in the morning, and this afternoon I talked about a model having to do with grief. And I knew at some level that this would probably catch up with me sooner or later today. I didn't know how. I knew halfway through the day that I was probably not going to make it. My reserves were running out really, really fast. And so I kind of braced myself for what was coming in the day. And I went into my last class, which is the one that is grief and loss. And I talked about a particular model. And lo and behold, I came full bore into a part of a particular model from grief, or looking at the process of grief, that has as the one of the tasks working through or processing the pain of the loss that the person has experienced. And in order to give my students a sense of what grief is like, is I happened onto a interaction. And it was completely mythical. It was completely fictional, but it was in the context of a Marvel character by the name of Wanda. And if you've ever seen it, it's a series that they did at the end of all the huge series of the Endgame and Infinity Wars and all that jazz. And it was called WandaVision. And so essentially, and I'll try not to ruin it for anybody that might want to watch it, but essentially, I don't know how I can keep from ruining it. Oh, well, whatever. So essentially, she falls in love, and she is a witch, but she falls in love with a guy by the name of Vision, who was before just a computer program, essentially. And then he was given a body, essentially, and they named him Vision, and he had what all the fight was about with the Infinity Stones and all of that kind of storyline that was part of MCU. And so by the end of the movies, the two big movies, he was gone. And so she decided to take it upon herself to change reality so that she could have him back. And so that really is kind of the story arc within WandaVision. And again, I don't want to ruin it too badly, but there is there's a conversation at the end between her and Vision. And really, the series is about handling grief, interestingly enough. I don't think that the creators of it had that in the back of their mind, but man, they bumped into and stumbled onto some pretty profound truths about grief and grieving and dealing with it, the aftermath of losing somebody very important. And in this interaction, Wanda is talking to Vision, who in the alternate reality is gone, but she's created a reality with him in it so she could have more time with him. And so she's having a conversation with this particular version of Vision. And she describes loss and the sense of grief that she has felt, and in like a wave, and it bowls her over, and she gets knocked down, and she gets up, and she gets knocked down again. And at some point she says, I really am very afraid that I'm just going to drown. And the interaction with Vision has been nothing but a machine. He has never had anyone to attach to even lose. So this whole idea of losing people and losing relationships is completely unknown to him. And he makes the comment, he said, but it's not all sorrow, is it? And what's remarkable about that statement is that that's true, that most of our sorrow is intermingled with laughter and pleasant memories and good things that we remember and we enjoy and we look back on fondly. But the sorrow is still there. And so it's intermingled, and that's what makes it really complicated for us, I think, in walking this particular journey. Well, anyway, the conversation continues, and he gets to the point of saying, and this got me. I literally, the dam broke, and the tears started flowing, and I wasn't going to get them back very quickly. But he basically said, is not love or is not grief nothing more than love enduring? And it just knocked me on my backside, because that's true. I think when we lose significant people in our lives, there's a trace left behind because of the love that we have for them. And it endures. It endures all the way through our process of grieving. It endures even into new relationships, even into moving into the future and things like that. And so it was a profound moment. But this day, I'm walking into doing this podcast, sitting down just like I said I would, and firing up the mic and just reflecting a little bit on the process and the journey of grief and what I'm experiencing and making some observations about that. So what is it you're listening to? You are listening to the Unscripted podcast. I'm Dr. Ray Mitch, your host. The subtitle for it is Collected Wisdom of Life, Living, and Sorrow. And for what it's worth, it's my own reflections about how sorrow really is embedded in all of our lives. Actually, if anything, sorrow gives it meaning. And so what I want to talk about tonight, last time I ended up landing on the topic of searching for right and doing it the right way and what we do to try to conform to whatever that quote-unquote right is. And it occurred to me this week as I was thinking about it and kind of gathering my thoughts for doing the podcast tonight, is there something else that we're searching for? We're not only searching for the right, which essentially says, if I'm doing it wrong, I want to do it right so that it will go better, so that it will go faster, so that I will heal quicker, whatever that formula is that you create. But there's something else that we are searching for in this early kind of winter of our grief, where we are experiencing various forms of denial, and we flip back and forth between disbelief and belief, and we kind of live in between knowing and not knowing. And what I mean by that is we know what life is like, but then when you remove a significant person from it, there's a significant element of it that is uncertain, and we just don't know. And it's not uncommon, certainly in the context of what I have known in talking to people over the years, is that they say, I don't know what to do next, because life continues on. I continue doing what I've always done, but I feel like I don't know that what's the next move, in a sense. And so when we have that kind of uncertainty, what we then do is we look for markers or reference points. And one of the first ones, like I mentioned last week, was the one of right. There's a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this. And if I'm doing it the right way, like I said, I will heal quicker. This will go a little faster. I will find shortcuts along the way. All of those kinds of things. Well, the other one we're searching for is what I would call normal. We're searching for just being normal. Now, we've got to be really careful, or we've got to at least take some time to define what normal is. I think most of the time, at least in the world of psychology, the standing joke is that the only place you're going to find normal as a setting is on the dryer. But life itself defies this categorization of this is normal and that's abnormal. There's a big, big, big band of what we might consider normal, but it's floating and usually defined by us anyway, the same way with right in a lot of cases. But normal is always a comparison point, which makes it very dangerous ultimately, because who's to say, if you will, who's to say that I'm normal and the other person isn't, or they're normal and I'm not? What's the standard? What do we use for it? And so, generally speaking, when we talk about, I wish it would just be normal again, oftentimes what we're actually talking about is getting back to the way things were. And that was normal. Now, we don't evaluate on this side of grief, after the person is gone, we don't really evaluate what that was like leading up to that and what the relationship was like. And if it was good, then I want that back. But it was contingent on them for that goodness. If it wasn't so good, it was also contingent on them and me. And how do I get it repaired and bring it back to normal? So see, in that instance, normal becomes what I want something to be rather than what it actually is. And we use the word normal to describe that state, if you will. So the problem with that is that we're trying to hit a target that's constantly moving. And when that happens, when we're in that state of saying, I just want it to be normal, don't ever define it, it's constantly moving, what that then leaves us with is that I'm always falling short. I'm never doing enough. There must be something I'm missing. And so let's start with one of these. The first one was, I want it the way it was before. Well, the way is basically having the person back in our lives and doing the things that we've always done with them in the past, right now, and that is considered normal. And while that is entirely understandable and relatable, I think everybody that has had it that way, and I have that when I look at whether it's a picture of the person that I've lost, or the texts that have been left behind, or the emails that I've gotten, or any number of things, I just wish I could be back there. Of course, reality in its cruel way says, yeah, but you're not. And the challenge is that my heart is back there, but my reality is here. And it's split. And the challenge is bringing my heart up to the place of where reality actually is. And that's what the grieving process ultimately is. In a lot of cases, is it's bringing my heart back into line with living in the here and now rather than the there and then. And so the way it was before has elements in it that at some level I think we all know will not be restored, which means it will never be normal. The interesting thing about it, even when you look at it from the perspective of various explanations of how the grieving process goes, people go into grief with what they consider to be normal. Now, like I said, whether that's a good relationship or a bad one, that's just the way that things were, and the way is considered normal. And so I go into that, and then the loss occurs, and everything is kind of thrown up in the air and uncertain, and I'm not sure, and what do I do next, and how do I feel, and sometimes I don't feel anything, and sometimes I'm overwhelmed, and like Wanda talked about, the wave rolling over me. I can be in any of those places all in the same day in a lot of ways. And so because of that, then, we are always in this state of ambiguity or this state of uncertainty that we just long for just knowing what we're doing. And denial is not always a bad thing, particularly in the grieving process, because it ultimately gives us some emotional breathing room to take pieces of our loss a little at a time. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. In the world of addictions, denial is always bad. It's usually a resistance to making the changes that need to be made. But in the grief world, in the world of grieving and recovery and healing from the loss that we've experienced, denial at the front end is actually a mercy in a lot of ways. I think God's designed us to walk this journey of grief if we're willing to let it go, move its course and move at its pace and give ourselves permission to be where we are rather than where we should be, and allow, you know, some small distractions that give me some breathing room emotionally to be able to come back to living in real life as it really is, not as I would have it. So normal is that very thing here. And usually the other part of this that I think we have to take into account is normal is asking, am I typical? Am I like other people? And like I said, it is dangerous to make a comparison with anyone else, because the one thing we know about grief and grieving is the pattern may be very similar, but the particulars of what each person experiences and how they experience it is thoroughly unique, and that is downright annoying for most people. Because then how do I know I've moved anywhere? How do I know that I'm getting anywhere? How do I know that I'm even healed, for that matter, is usually the questions that come up. And generally, not to sound Yoda-like, but we'll know it when you get there. And it's not a matter of give me the 10 criteria that says that I've healed. It will be very obvious by the time we get there. The problem is we are seeking an outcome instead of fully engaged in the process. And the process is called this journey of grief. And we in the Western world, we are very driven by product, by producing some outcome that is desirable. And the process, we oftentimes spend less time thinking about or worrying about. And what we miss is that if I don't spend the time engaging in a healthy process, then there is no way that I can expect a healthy outcome. Because process, and kind of a tangent really briefly, but in psychology, we talk about that too, is you have to have a person, the psychologists themselves, a good process about how do we enter in and help somebody, and then we have a product. And that may be healing, that may be some measure of health or increased health. It may be any number of things. But the person and the process are vitally, vitally important, because the nature of the person engaging in it is key, and having a good process. And oftentimes I will say to people who are walking through this journey, which I am now on, and so I'm just a fellow traveling companion here, is we have to trust the process. What that means is processing, talking about what I'm experiencing, looking back on it and reassuring myself that I'm on the right journey here, I'm on the right path. It doesn't feel that way. And I might look for people that have done the journey before that, and they say, hey, this is what it looks like. So relax, take a deep breath. There's not a right way or a normal way to do this. There's a way to engage fully with your heart and what's going on in it. Do the demands by life change or let up? No, they don't. That's the worst part about all of this, is that I walk the journey of grief, and I still have to get up in the morning and come into school and teach classes and engage and interact with students and everything that I normally do. And it's to some degree, it's not compartmentalizing. I think compartmentalizing has gotten way overblown, because our tendency is with compartmentalizing is we box it up, close the door, and never come back to it. And then what we find out later, lo and behold, is that the box leaks, and all the things that I have boxed up into that compartment is leaking into my emotional water table, and it affects all of my other relationships. That's why it's so important to set the grief process aside. We can call a timeout for a second, do the things we need to do, and then come back to it, whatever that looks like. And usually it's a little different when we come back. But the one thing I said to my students today, which is true, is that my baseline, all right, I rally to have the energy, to have the goodwill, the animation, the joking around, having a good time, teaching and everything else. I can rally to do that. But my baseline is sadness, and I always return to it. And that's not a bad thing, because when we lose people of importance in our lives that we love, sadness is the outcome because of the cost of love. In so many ways, and another author has written it that way, is that the cost of love is grief. And like Vision said, is grief is love enduring. And so we have to find some way, whether it's someone else's voice that says, hey, you are on the right track. Take care of yourself. Be gentle with yourself. Don't make demands when you're not ready. And be sensitive to you're spent and you have no energy left, and allow that to be the case. It won't always be that way. It may not feel that, but it won't always be that way. And so allow that process to take place. We oftentimes in our grieving process do things in spurts when we have the energy oftentimes. And that means talking to people, processing things, journaling, maybe visiting a graveside, or going through belongings that are gifts that we've gotten from the person, whatever it might be. And we have the energy to do it. We do those things, and then we kind of sink back to the baseline, whatever your baseline is, and then do the things we have to, come back to it, check in, see what's going on, what is there in terms of sensitivity and rawness. Because remember, when I started this podcast, I made mention of the fact of the metaphor that I have used many times before, that grief is like a psychological burn wound. And the healing process is oftentimes having to scrub the wound, touch it to see where it's still raw and sensitive and tender, and to treat it with care, not treat it with disrespect or anything like that, and because it shouldn't be there. And see, again, there are so many times throughout all of this process that the process of shame enters in. It's like we make comparisons to life as it should be rather than living in the life that we already have. And that is true because sorrow is woven into the tapestry of all of our lives. We have smaller ones along the way, changes in job, changes in image, broken relationships, all manner of things that really are warm-ups for this kind of grief that we experience. And so we have to take the time to treat ourselves with care. if somebody comes into the ER and the doc looks at them and says, you got a broken arm, so go on home, take a couple aspirin, let me know how you're doing in the morning, we would be indignant because we want to be treated with care because of the pain that we're in. We have to figure out a way not only to have people in our lives that are willing to do that for us, but also, almost as importantly, the one person that we live with 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is me. And I have to find a way to treat myself with care as well as being blessed by the care of other people around me, whether that's through encouragement or other means. Sensitivity is another one. And so we can't underestimate how desperately we want certainty back. And that's what this search for normal really is all about, is I want some certainty. I want to be able to predict what's going to happen next. I want to be able to have my expectations match an old reality, because that's what we defined as normal, rather than the one that I'm living in. And all of this, that's why this is a journey, because I'm moving from point A, the loss of the person, to point B, where it's not a new normal. It's a reinvestment in a different life. That's what it is. Because if we call it new normal, then we're going to use the old normal as the standard for the new one, and they will never match. But what we have is we were in what we would call normal life coming into it. That got destroyed. And now we're having to rebuild to get to the point where I am reinvesting in life, and I'm not necessarily trying to move into the future. I am simply reinvesting in the life that I have as it is, not as I would have it, and being able to engage it in those ways. And so the search for being right is a reference point. The search for being normal is also a reference point. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing to do. The problem is that we run the risk of sabotaging our forward movement, if you will, because there is so much about grief that is really upside down. The harder I try to manage and control the outcome, the less healing I will find. The more that I invest in the process of doing the things I know to do, or I have people speaking into my life that help me understand what this process is like, and doing those things rather than trying to engineer things so they look just right by the time I get to that point, which I can't see anyway, then I will probably find it. And by the time I get there, which is a key phrase, by the time I get there, I will be saying, I'm not real sure how I got here, but I walked this journey. I had key companions along the way. I had opportunities to invest in the process as well in my own, journey, and thinking back through things and reflecting on things and struggling and handling. And maybe that's what we need to talk about the next time, is just my own expectations of God in the whole thing and how things went down and the nature of that. Because our tendency is to look for somebody to blame, and we either blame ourselves, we blame God, or we blame people that are related to that the process. And that's, a very natural part of the process. And that's kind of what I'm talking about through doing a podcast like this, because it's life, living, and sorrow, right? And life and living, our tendency is very similar to the kinds of things we tend to do to either sabotage our journey through grief or engage it fully to the degree that I can and walk this journey with patience and kindness and grace toward myself, and trust that process. And when I get there, I'll get there, and probably I will know it when I get there from either the encouragement of friends or my own process of understanding the things that are changing in me And even the change itself can be a mixed bag, because our change and healing can threaten our connection. I played another video clip this today in the lecture that I was doing, and the lady said, I wanted to hang on to my pain from my son's, and he was lost in a firefight as a Marine, because that's all I had left of him. And again, all of this, I want to underscore this, and you'll keep hearing me say this all along, all of that is very normal, because we're trying to pull kind of elements from the past into the present, and as we drag them, they distort along the way. And that's the challenge, I think, of this journey, is moving ahead without trying to pull the past with us. It's not unusual that we do. And the thing about this, and I'll end on this point, the thing about the grief journey is that it's a lot like any kind of athletic game. And the difference between winning and losing is who makes the less number of mistakes. Now, granted, they outscore them, all that. You can do that math yourself. But the team that makes the fewer mistakes is usually the one that ends up winning. And they cover over for a lot of mistakes a lot of times. And that's the same way with the grief process, is we will do unhealthy things throughout the process. That obviously, that doesn't give us permission to do those things, but they will happen because we're human and we're going to make mistakes and we're going to lapse into old behaviors and old habits and old habits of comfort and all of those things that come up along the way. So, and that's what's key here, I think, in the search. We search everywhere for normal. We search everywhere for what's right. We search for some clues, something that will tell me that I'm on the right course. And again, we can look at some patterns, and maybe one of these episodes I'll talk about a particular pattern you might consider. But we can look at some of those patterns and apply them to us and say how they apply. But the particulars, my history, the person I have lost, the relationship I've had, close or distant, whatever that might be, or a long time ago versus now, all of that has a direct impact ultimately on the grieving process and what that actually looks like. Not the least of which is culture, the culture I'm in. And culture, I don't mean like other country cultures. I'm talking about cultures just even within our country is different from one area or region to another. So all of that is part of this blurring kind of context in which we're trying to do stuff and we're trying to walk this journey of grief, one, without usually having any idea how to do it because we've never done it before, because of the significance of the person. And secondly, we want to get it over as fast as possible, which oftentimes actually sabotages our effort to get it done at all. The harder I work to get it over as quickly as possible, it will often tempt me into some of these things that I was talking about earlier. So that is it for tonight. Thanks so much for joining me. If you are so inclined to support SGI, the Stained Glass International, that allows me to do this, please feel free to donate and support it. There are a variety of ways to do that, whether that's on the website at sgi-net.org and using the donate button, or you can send us a check if you want to do that. But anything helps in order to help us to continue, or help me to be able to continue to do things like this, and to do retreats and to be able to implement the vision of having groups. I would love to see us have a group on grief and loss that will allow us to talk through and work through various issues that I'm talking about in this podcast as well. So if you're so inclined, we are tax deductible, tax exempt organization. So all of your gifts and donations are tax deductible. And we would be ever, and I would be ever so appreciative of your generosity in that regard and partnership. So I think that's it for tonight. Again, I look forward to seeing you back here in about a week. And I will be here. And until that time, love you. Later. Bye.